Stevens, Senator Lincoln, Senator Elton, soon Senator Wilkins, who's out in the hall talking to somebody, and myself, Senator Ferguson. We're going to take up HB 241 first. We're going to hear the testimony on this bill and then hold it. But I wanted to get it on the committee members' radar screen, so I have a few concerns. Come on up, Representative James, and give us your testimony on it. I have spoke to the sponsor about some of these concerns, and we'll talk about those and see where we want to go when you finish your testimony. So go ahead, Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Representative Jeanette James. I am the sponsor of House Bill 241. I appreciate you, Mr. Chairman, hearing this bill today, and I am anxious to get something passed yet this year, and I am sure that with our conversation that you will be working for the same goals. The particular rationale for having filed this piece of legislation in the first place was, for one, is to increase the size of the transportation and utility corridor from 300 feet wide to 500 feet wide. There is already a corridor that goes from Fairbanks that's been identified for over 20 years now that does go from Fairbanks to the Canadian border, and it was selected by a center line from the air and has been on the map. In fact, as you may recall, a few years ago when there was a little glitch and the DOT took it off of the map, and then we passed a piece of legislation to put it back on the map so that we have that. And so for the information of those of you who may not know, I have been working now for nearly 10 years to affect a railroad connection to the North American rail system, which this would do. Have had lots of support on the other side of the border as well as within the state. That's been accelerating a little bit in the last 4 years, and we're hoping that we can get something done here. The acceleration is partially responsible for Senator Murkowski's getting on board, pun intended, passing the bilateral commission for a feasibility study at the federal level. We're still waiting for the Canadians to agree to do the same thing. And I understand their holdup is they don't want to put in any money. We have $6 million at the federal level for this three-year process. And so I don't know whether they're objecting to appointing specific members that would be needed to be done from the Canadian side. So this then would authorize the railroad to survey on the ground and monument this railroad corridor no less than 500 feet wide. And the other reason, let me slip in here, for doing this now is because there is a great interest in the state for a gas pipeline that might go down the same area. We wanted to be sure that the railroad or the gas line wasn't excluded one from the other by the railroad taking a position and or the gas line taking a position that didn't leave anything left for the other. In fact, there's good argument, and we've had a lot of discussion with the gas producers group, that there may be some synergies with the railroad and the construction of the gas line that might be in a benefit to that whole process. So that's another reason why we came forward with this at this point in time. The next reason is that this particular piece of legislation authorizes the railroad to go to Whitehorse and Yukon. And that is just indicates in the section 4240.
Can you hold on a second? Sure. Oh,
for those softball questions.
We're apparently not on the record because the telecom was cut off. So can we just take a short at ease
sure
in place
can.
While we Thank you. Sorry for that inconvenience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the last section in the piece of legislation just says that the corporation may investigate extension of the Alaska Railroad from the border of Canada and Canada and of Alaska and Canada to Whitehorse, Yukon. And the rationalization for that, on my part at least, is that if we do make this connection, if we manage to get to Whitehorse, that's about halfway to wherever the next connection was, so that just kind of a giving a little hand up to Canada on that issue. But the other issue is that the White Pass rail does go to Whitehorse. They haven't currently been utilizing that rail. They only come up as far as Carcross, but they had indicated to me last year when I was there, you know, if the rail got to Whitehorse, they certainly would come to Whitehorse. That would open the deep water port at Skagway for some of the eastern part of Alaska and the Yukon Territory for another methodology of getting out their resources, whatever that, and in their equipment and supplies that they might want to do with a water source. So it's simply just to give them the authorization to investigate that potential. The other part of this, which may be controversial, more controversial, is the part of that once the railroad has gotten the funds from some other source, we're not authorizing any funds nor asking for any funds in this, but allow them to either bond or to get federal money or some other way to spend the money, to get the money to do the surveying and identifying this route, that then when that was identified, that we would transfer the state land within that corridor to the railroad for them to have in their ownership with the rest of their ownership that they have in the existing lines. And then the rest of the land ownerships in that area would then have to be pursued in whatever kind of methodology they could get to get that arrangement. The other thing is that when we did this corridor by the center line at the in the air more than 20 years ago, many things have changed in the land ownership and the uses along this area. And so it may well be that in getting on the ground and determining where this should go, they may have to make some changes in the direction of the already delineated route in order to either avoid some conflicts or even in the land and water and other kinds of conditions that might have to be met. There is a NASA did a flyover, I believe it was not this last summer, I think it was the summer before, with a high resolution evaluation of this whole area from Eielson to the border. And then it's currently being mapped now in DNR, and they're not quite finished with that, but will be soon, to show what the topography and also the geology is along this entire route. So we're anxious to be able to get that. The other issue that may be conflictive with at least the department is that for this route and for the other route that in 1994 I authorized to go from Fairbanks to the Seward Peninsula, that it excludes the requirement of a Title 38 in identifying the use of the lands, and that's simply because that does expedite the area and leave out a lot of the conflict that would be happening. The railroad, incidentally, does have eminent domain authority. It does repeat that statement in this piece of legislation, but they already have it without having it in here. And we're looking at this as a transportation and utility corridor wide enough to possibly include fiber optics or even electrical transmission lines or anything else that would need to be going in this corridor in the future, so that we would already have identified, and when an EIS would be prepared, that it would include all the potential kinds of transportation that would be available to be in this corridor. So that's the general about what the bill is all about and what the purpose of it is for, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Maybe I'll start us out, and we've had this conversation, but I'm not sure that all the members of the committee know this, but the first issue that I'd like us to discuss, I guess, is basically on page 2, line 18 to 22. There's several things in there. One is that this gives DNR the authority to transfer the land without the legislature having another bite at the apple. I've heard rumblings that they would like to see a report come back when it's completed and then do the final transfer.
Well, we have talked about that, Mr. Chairman, and as well, I believe this may be falling into the same category as the university lands bill, in which case we probably do have to have a separate appropriation for that land, and certainly that language could be included here. I've discussed this with the railroad as well, and it does not necessarily negatively affect what I have here or change the direction that we'd be going. So that certainly is something that could be in the bill.
Any comments on that particular thing at all, Senator Taylor?
Just a question. I thought that was still being litigated by the Supreme Court.
Well, the university one is, on whether or not the veto override is an appropriation or not. I think that this would clearly be a simple majority, but it's just a question. I mean, it's not a supermajority for appropriation. But the comments that I've been hearing is that maybe this should come back after everything's completed, so we can get one more look at the final project. And that's, but it's really not tied into the veto override issue, at least not in my mind, unless this is vetoed. If this is vetoed, then you may be at the standard of 45 votes for override instead of 40.
Depending on which way the Supremes go, yeah.
Depending on their language in the bill.
Depending on the language. If we make it passive where it'll come back to the legislature again, clearly it's not an appropriation. We're saying that'll happen at a future time. Okay, the second part was actually on page, line 19 on the same page, the reference to 4240-370, and 4240-370 transfers the corporation ownership control of the surface materials, mineral estates, the right to use the timber, construction materials, gravel rock, the right to channel ditch. But anyway, it transfers to them, it appears to me, all the subsurface rights. And I don't know if did we get a legal opinion on that?
It is subsurface.
It is subsurface. So, but we've asked the drafters about that, and we were, clearly the oil and gas, I don't think we're interested in giving to the railroad. The gravel rights, if we happen to build a road, which would probably be a miracle in this state, but if we happen to build a road, I don't think we'd want to buy the gravel back, transfer it and then buy it back. So we were trying to work on an equal access issue to where the state could take gravel out of the right of way if they needed it, but still achieve the purpose that we want to for the railroad.
Well, and on that, I have no problem with that either, Mr. Chairman. In fact, is I had never intended it to be including subsurface rights with exception to gravel, and of course they will need gravel to be able to build the railroad. And I've discussed this with the railroad as well. And there certainly would be language that could go in here. There's when you think about the state having access to the gravel, and it's in a railroad right of way. I think the railroad would have to have some kind of management of that sort of process. And we could insert in here something that if there was gravel needed for state roads or whatever, that the railroad would then could transfer it at cost, whatever it is, if it was in a pile of gravel or wherever it was that could be done. And certainly if there is some gravel, and I know we have a big shortage of gravel in the state for various different places for roads, if the gravel is along a railroad, I can tell you it's going to be better at getting that gravel to the road production than if the railroad wasn't there.
I don't have a problem with trying to meet the original intent of your bill, and that's to give them the gravel. But at the same point, if we do road upgrades and need that gravel, we shouldn't have to buy it. That's the point. We took one run, and we had the conversation with drafting, and we couldn't come up with, at least in my standards, appropriate drafting, appropriate language, so we're still working on that. There's some confusion as to who would be the boss, and we need to, who would control the rights. Could the railroad tell the state no, or other way around, could the state tell the railroad no if that happens? So we're working on that. The third issue you mentioned is the easement for the gas line. I think your bill is clear enough to me, but there are people within DNR that don't think it says it quite the way it should, so we prepared an amendment that would clearly say that a pipeline could go down through there, so. And we'll have to look at that one. And the last one is just more of a statement. I have a little bit of question on giving the railroad authority to own property in Canada. And I don't know if it's just my conspiracy theory working on me or what, but clearly the last sentence of the bill, the corporation may acquire land or interest in Canada, so they could actually, interest could be anything, I guess you could buy another railroad over there. And I'm not really sure, and I know we have some Mr. Kubitz and other folks online, and maybe they'd like to comment on that, but I maybe that's how you make this deal work, but it's just send up a red flag to me, that's all. Senator Taylor.
A couple of concerns on that in the utility corridor, and that was we went through quite an argument around here about what the cost of a utility right-of-way would be for fiber optic purposes when it crossed parklands and DNR lands and university lands, and everybody had a different, every agency of the state had a different price, and it was kind of whatever the market would bear and whatever they could work out with them, and literally they went in the back room with the governor and cut a deal. I don't want to see that same kind of silliness go on in this utility corridor. I don't want to see the railroad sitting there saying, well, yeah, we've got a right-of-way, and we've got plenty of room, we've got track here, and we can run your pipeline down it, but here's how much you have to pay us. Or the same thing with the fiber optic, which they did, and we had testimony on just yesterday, that it was the fiber optic contract alone for the railroad renders a very significant income for them. In fact, we found out yesterday that they don't make any money running a railroad. They make their money off of fiber optics and land sales. They're in the land business. And so I do have concerns about this, that other activities that we as a state may wish to do, we'll find ourselves dealing with a board, none of them subject to election, appointed by whoever the governor happens to be at the time, and they sit down and work out whatever deal they want to work out that's beneficial to the railroad from a proprietary purpose, but may not be very beneficial to the people of Alaska that want fiber optic or want a gas pipeline. I'm concerned about that. So maybe you could respond to those concerns.
Well, I certainly share your concerns. I wouldn't be doing this bill at all if I didn't have the belief that this is going to be a benefit to Alaska as a whole. And that we have a lot of stranded resources in the state, and that they would have some potential of being developed if we have a better connection to where the people are, where the supplies and equipment is, and that will assist us. In the long scheme of things, it appears to me that whatever the railroad has a right-of-way on, for safety reasons, needs to certainly be managed by the railroad. That's one of the reasons why that they would want to have that control. We do have some places even now in the state where I think we're in violation of that. And one of them is along the railroad corridor on the way to Ferry, where we have the only access road in that is on the railroad right-of-way. If some piece of something would fall off of the railroad as they're going by and somebody's driving by and gets hurt, you know, it's going to be the railroad's fault. And yet we have not been able to, through the state DOT or any other means, and I've tried it, to be able to move that road over off of the railroad right-of-way, and it's very narrow there. So I think that in this whole thing, you have to think about, and I leave these kinds of issues up to the railroad, who's much smarter about those things than I am. But I'm concerned, and my whole purpose for doing this isn't just to spend money and cause people problems. And in talking to the railroad, of course, they're interested in, and if something needs to be in here that would make that not necessarily be a giveaway, but be able to balance. Quite frankly, I'm not real happy with all of the ways that the right-of-ways are treated in the state of Alaska. I think that we need to be a little more general in everything that we do. And so I understand your concerns. And so having said that, you know, I'm reserve my attitude towards what changes you might make till I see them, but I'm certainly willing to make them, providing that the end result works and gets us where we want to go on this issue.
Senator Taylor, do you have a fix in mind?
No, I really don't, but my only concern is why do we need to give them title to the 500 feet width? For them to decide how everything's going to happen in there, why don't they just have a right-of-way or easement for the use of that portion, but not an exclusive right-of-way or easement? I don't know why the right-of-way or easement has to be exclusive to them. They can build it and put their railroad in it. Somebody else could come to the state and say that's a state utility easement or right-of-way. What do I need to comply with your regulations and to be compatible with the other users within that corridor? And they come back to us as opposed to coming to the railroad.
Let me see if I get you. So instead of 500 foot, maybe you do 100 or 150, but you still make the 500 foot corridor. But the railroad has exclusive right on the 100 foot for the railroad.
I would give them the exclusive right to run a railroad on that 100 foot. I wouldn't give them the exclusive right to control all other uses that might be compatible with theirs. I mean, I don't understand why it needs to be exclusive. They just need it to run a railroad. They don't need to own any subsurface. They don't need to own any of the rest of it. They just need to be able to use this for one purpose. We only give, as an example, they condemn and take your property. And they're going to have, or you sign off and give them an easement to put a road across that property. If for some reason they ever take that road out of there, that property reverts back to the original owner. So, I mean, unless you're going to give them, I don't know why we need to give them fee title to 500 feet wide and the exclusive jurisdiction over controlling anybody that crosses it. And, I mean, you're talking about a mess. Somebody needs to get access to their property. They need to go across it. And now the railroad says, well, you've got to build the bridge and you've got to, I mean, there could be, down the road, this thing needs to be as flexible as possible and yet provide the railroad the benefit that it needs. And I was advocating for that railroad 18 years ago. So I want to see it happen, just like Representative James did.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond to that specific issue. One of my rationales, and you may say this just doesn't mean anything, is that currently what the railroad has in the state is fee simple title to their railroad corridor, and I just believe that it should all be the same. On the second part, if you were going to have a railroad corridor that is larger than what is needed, and I suppose the minimum is 100 feet from the center line, would allow you to have one track. I suspect that we will have to have some double tracks. We'll have to have also some ancillary things along the way. And I believe that whatever the width of that railroad track needs to be under the control, whatever that is, needs to be under control of the railroad. For safety reasons. They have to be able to make the rules of how the behavior goes in that, because it is a safety issue. Beyond that, one of the considerations that I had and why I filed this piece of legislation, which if I hadn't wanted to widen the area for 500 feet, is that we could have just kept the one we have. But I just don't think that's going to work. And so that's one of the reasons I did. If we do this, and if there is an EIS to do the railroad down there, I was of the opinion that we could do the whole thing at once. And so when it comes to putting a transmission liner down, whatever, it'll be already done. We don't have to go through that big, long process, maybe just a little updating. So that was my reason for doing it. I don't share the same concern that you do, Senator Taylor, on that issue. I don't think it's that much of a problem what we already have. And I know that in Fairbanks we're now working with federal money to try to make separated grade crossings over, I believe it's 46 different at-grade crossings. And the goal is to have separated grade crossings, not at-grade crossings.
Senator Lincoln.
I was just reading some of the information in the packet here and some of the previous testimony from the House side, and one of the questions that was raised is on page 1 talking about the corridor, line eight, that the corridor shall be at least 500 feet wide. There's no maximum amount that's put in there, but just the minimum. Is there a reason that you would put a minimum and not a maximum?
Yes, because sometimes with turns and hills and other kinds of things that you need wider area of covering besides just the corridor. It's not like building a highway, which generally you make it go in where you want it to go, but with the inclines and other things with the rail, sometimes it takes a larger, wider area.
But wouldn't we know what that maximum could be?
Not until they do the, I don't believe you can until they do the surveying and identify exactly where the track would be going.
Oh, it just seems to me that if we're talking about a corridor that that you're giving to the railroad and you allow them to designate what that width would be, should be of some concern. It just seems like if that you would know what the very maximum would be for any turns or any other considerations.
Well,
for
Mr.
a corridor.
Chairman, Senator Lincoln, certainly by the nothing is going to happen about transferring this land or identifying this land until the survey and the monuments are done on the ground. And at that time, you would know if you've designed where the railroad is going. You would know where the wide spots are and where the narrower spots are. So I think that we don't know what it is now, but it would be whatever's required.
Other questions, Senator Elton?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I think this may have been asked before, but I apologize because I can't remember the answer. The bill proposes that the corporation can identify a corridor, and again, referring to page 2, lines 18 through 23, it says the DNR shall, in accordance with the cited statutes, convey state land within the railroad utility corridor. What happens, I mean, who negotiates if, in fact, there are prior claims to that? I mean, whether they're mineral claims or farm leases or other claims on that land, I mean, who negotiates that? Does DNR negotiate that, or is land transferred and then the railroad corporation would deal with previous claims to the corridor?
Well, this is the one area that we're thinking about changing the language in, so anything's open as to make changes, but it would be my understanding that if DNR were to be transferring any land to anyone for any reason, they would have to identify the existing rights, whatever they happen to be. And that generally, if you buy a piece of property that has existing rights on it, you either, one of two things, you either make an agreement of some sort to compensate or provide satisfaction to the existing rights, or you accept the land with existing rights there. I mean, that's the way you usually transfer property, and I would assume this would be done the same way. If it needs to be clearer in the statute, we can certainly, there's certainly language that could.
So if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So what I'm hearing is that it wouldn't be up to DNR, it would be up to the corporation to extinguish those previous existing rights that might conflict with their use, and so they would incur any costs that might be associated with extinguishing those rights.
Senator Kroger. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. Senator Taylor.
What is meant by the words associated rail land that I see on line 17 and it's several different places?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, it may be better for you to ask that of the railroad, and there are some people on that will be available to testify, but my understanding would be for sidings, for other kinds of facilities along the line that they might have. Railroads do have different kinds of equipment and buildings, and there will be probably a passenger station or a freight place for people to bring in freight. There's just all those other kinds of ancillary items that they would be needing to have in their plan to be able to have an effective and a usable railroad.
That would be outside of the corridor?
Not necessarily. It would be probably part of the corridor.
I thought maybe it meant rail lands that they already owned or something that was going to go by and they would consolidate
them. I don't know that there's any rail lands out in that.
Is there any definition in here of associated rail land? I mean, I vision a corridor, a couple straight parallel lines at 500 feet apart going along. Do you envisage a jog that goes out for a quarter mile or something to give them associated land for some other purpose?
Well, there might be, Mr. Chairman, if I might, there might be material sites and or there might be a place where they will have sidings so they can pass trains in the night and or some buildings, some place to load things if you're into Tok area and they're wanting to load logs as an example or lumber or whatever they're doing. They do have a mill over there that is also doing dry kiln lumber. If they wanted to ship something, they have to have a methodology of loading it, and so there's platforms and those kinds of things, and that would have to be designed in their property, within their property borders, I would believe. Either right of way or ownership, whichever it happened to be, they would have to have that right of way.
I guess all I was asking was, I understand a conveyance as intended of 500 acres fee simple basically to the railroad, or 500 feet fee simple to the railroad, but I just wondered if associated rail land would mean that you would convey not only that 500 feet, but an additional area near it or around it, and if there was any limitation or definition or on what that might be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Taylor, I don't think we could describe that specifically until such time as what is requested by this piece of legislation is the authorization for them to do the on-the-ground survey and monumental.
In my mind, that's why we have it come back and take a look at it.
I think, and I agree with you.
It's not in here now, but you may very well put a railroad station in that is a mile wide. I don't know, half a mile, and a bunch of tracks. I hope so. Well, I could particularly see that in Greeley, you know, if something happened in a, you know, the missile defense and everything else picks up, then
yeah,
I could see four or five tracks wide or something in there, loading docks. Hopefully we're moving timber. We haven't cut a tree in 10 years, have we?
Right.
Okay, thank you. I think we... anybody online? I guess we have Jim and somebody else there, the finance director. Do you guys have any comment at this time? Are you even there at this time? He's having a press conference right now on that. Okay. We will set this bill aside, and I'll work with the sponsor. We'll try to, I'm not sure how we're going to work on this corridor stuff, but...
Mr. Chairman.
But I will...
Excuse me.
Well, I didn't want you to go on to the next before. I wanted to ask a question. Was DNR going to testify on this today, or are they...
Anybody want to testify on this today?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Bill Britt is on online. He's from
Bill Britt.
Yeah, Mr. Bill Britt. He's from the...
On the railroad?
No, on the HB 241, the land situation.
Oh, all right.
And I don't know, maybe he's...
Well, I don't have a sign-up sheet. We don't get those here in resources.
Maybe he could answer
okay,
any
Bill,
questions.
Are you online?
Thompson, yes, I am.
Okay, do you have some comments you'd like to make?
I'll make them brief. For the record, my name is Bill Britt. I'm the gas pipeline coordinator within the Department of Natural Resources. My testimony is to identify several concerns. The majority of ours have been identified in your testimony, so I'll be very brief. First, there's likely to be some overlap between the railroad corridor and the gas pipeline right of way, as has been indicated. Any gas pipeline right of way land transferred to the railroad to the state reduces the state control over authorization, construction, operation, and maintenance determination of the gas pipeline. The transfer would also reduce state lease payments and may also affect the tariff in the turn would allow the Commissioner of DNR to identify areas where there may be some other state interests involved that should be considered. The Senator Elton identified the fact that existing valid existing rights on lands that would be conveyed do not appear to be protected at this point. The bill should be made should make the conveyance subject to those third party interests. The state's the ability to protect the state's mineral interest in the land is, was mentioned by you, Senator Torgerson. And we believe the bill should make the transfer subject to 3805-125. The bill does not protect public use and access within and across the corridor. At a minimum, the bill should make the transfer subject to 3805-127, retaining access along navigable waterways. The committee may wish to consider doing more. Fifth, the bill, as was previously mentioned, the bill doesn't make clear who bears the expenses associated with the conveyance. And as, again, has already been mentioned by Senator Lincoln, there doesn't appear to be an upper limit on the amount of land that could be required to be conveyed, since the minimum is set and no maximum is given. And that's it. Thank you, sir.
Is there any part of the bill you like? Bill, what's the difference between 3805-125 and 3805-035? Do you know right offhand?
Senator Torgerson, I have Dick Miley in the Division of Mine, Land, and Water with me, and he may know.
Okay, well, I can look it up, too. I just thought maybe you might know, since you referenced 125. The bill references 035, and I was just curious what the difference was.
Pretty quick answer. Dick Miley is the Department of Natural Resources.
Hi, Dick.
The 3805-125 is the reservation of mineral rights for the state. It's the language that we use whenever we convey these land and now state ownership. You retain the put the list of all mineral rights we retain that is required under the private.
Oh, I got you. Okay. So do you agree that 424370 transfers mineral rights? Or did you look that up, Dick?
That was DNR's assumption of it.
Yeah. That's what I thought, too. Okay. Well, we're going to draft some language to correct that, and we'll shop it with you before we come back. Okay, Senator Elton, quickly.
Just a comment, and maybe it's more for Carol Carroll. I mean, the only fiscal note we have in the packet is a fiscal note that affects DCED and was written by the staff to the Senate Transportation Committee. It may be appropriate to ask DNR to think about potential costs and prepare a fiscal note.
She's writing that down as we speak. Okay. Jim Kubitz with the railroad. You online now, Jim? Not quite, but we'll turn up some volume here. Did you have comments on this, or are you just standing by for questions? Do you have comments on the bill, or are you just there to answer questions?
Well, I'm just there to answer questions, mostly.
Okay. Senator Taylor.
Yeah, Jim, could the railroad's purpose not be just as well provided for instead of granting you fee simple title to 500 foot of right-of-way across the state? Couldn't you be accommodated just as well with an easement within a declared utility corridor that was still retained and owned by the state?
Well, that depends on really the lane of businesses you expect to accomplish on this railroad. As Representative James said, we have a model now which we own our land and can do other things with it. So we prefer to do that for sure. We just don't know if the business case, the long-term business case on this piece of land, on this piece of rail yet. We hope it'll be profitable, but if it isn't, we may need to do other things on the land until it is. And one other comment, I think it was your Senator Taylor, about associated land. Every now and then we have to turn the train around. You know, we can't turn the train in a 500-foot corridor. So 350 miles or so, we need a bigger piece of land to do that in. So there is associated land due to rail operations or maybe an intermodal facility unloading and unloading that would be necessary outside of this 500-foot corridor. But until we design that thing and get it surveyed and know where those places should be, we won't know exactly.
And that could also be accomplished by an easement, couldn't it?
Exclusive easement, probably.
Well,
I'm
not talking about an exclusive easement. You're talking about an exclusive easement, and you're talking about owning the land, because as a railroad, you're not sure what kind of business you're going to be in. I want you to stay in the railroad business.
Yeah.
I don't intend to give you, I don't know how many thousand acres that is, of land and resources and mineral rights, so you can go into the oil drilling business or go into the land selling business or the land leasing business. I'm excited about you operating a railroad and finally making, hopefully, a profit off of it. Not doing it off of land.
Even gravel back and forth, so you don't really know what you're going to need it for until you really have your business case.
But you have the right to condemn today and take for such lands as you need,
right.
And you would also have, through this legislation, an easement wherever you needed a corridor for purposes of running a railroad.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Okay. She's on the line about how she feels this would work subject to our current model.
Yes, I'm on the line here in Anchorage. Good afternoon, Senators. And I think I would add to that that from the railroad perspective, we would certainly, we don't have to have full fee title. It's an administrative convenience, certainly, to just kind of treat all of the land we're involved with the same way, but we can certainly differentiate. What we would need to be especially careful about, though, is in crafting or defining the language that creates this easement interest, even if we don't say exclusive, because I know that raised a few eyebrows just a second ago when Jim said exclusive, we still need to be able to have a very strong say about other activities, and again, we get back to the safety sort of angle of things. So even if we have an easement, we would need to be careful how we define it so that the railroad can protect both itself and the public and the environment, you know, and all of the interests there from those kind of peculiar railroad hazards that go along with the kind of business we're in. So as long as we kind of manage to give us a pretty strong position to address those, you know, you can call it an easement or you can call it a duck, you know, it doesn't matter as long as we are able to protect those important public interests.
I understand that. Thank you very much.
Phyllis, could you give us your full name and occupation and all that business?
Yes, sir. I'm Phyllis Johnson, and I am Vice President and General Counsel, Railroad.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And then for either you or Jim, I just had one question about why we would want to give you authority to own land and, what's the other term, land or interest in Canada. Is that an important provision, or is that, well, how does that shake out?
All we're after is let Phyllis operate to control our corridor and our right of way for our own reasons.
Right.
There's not any interest in any more land we really need in Canada for sure.
Yes, sir, and this is Phyllis Johnson again. I guess I would say one could envision that kind of right there at the border. You probably, because of interchange with the other rail lines and other activities, you know, will have to have a fairly spread out area to work in right there. And it's probably just envisioned that we might be able to either buy or lease a little additional land to kind of, you know, given how the geography is, to make that work out right there at the border.
Okay. Well, it's all right with you guys. When we get the CS drafted to pick up some of these concerns, we'll run this language by and see if we can work on some kind of compromise. Senator Taylor.
Yeah, thank you.
Phyllis, would it be possible for you to draft an easement or a paragraph that would indicate what the essential elements of an easement providing for a priority of use by the railroad, but not an exclusive use? And if you could do that and send that down to my office, it would help us in restructuring this legislation.
Yes, sir, I can take a stab at it, and I will probably use a lot of what's in the Federal Transfer Act as my guide, because that's what the federal government kind of attempted to do, was guarantee to the state that cover all those bases of the most important interests that need to be protected.
Yeah,
so I will certainly do that and get it down to you in a day or so.
Thank you, it'd be very helpful.
You're welcome.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. Anybody here wish to testify? Now I have a Brian Harris online. What are you here to testify for, Brian?
Okay. Sorry, it took me a minute to get here. Now this is Brian Harris with KMXT Radio. We're just waiting to get some audio feed on the salmon task force.
Oh, I got you. Okay, thank you, Brian. How about Karen Morrissey?
Senator, she's with the Alaska Railroad, too, and I don't believe she's online anymore.
Oh, okay, good. All right. I'm sorry. They just didn't have, they just had a question mark, so I wasn't sure what they were there to testify. Okay. That appears that all we have for testimony today. We'll set this bill aside and go to work on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Thank you, Representative. Next, we'll go to 319, Senate Bill 319. It's introduced by me, I think. Okay. Introduced by me. It's an act relating to shallow natural gas leasing and providing for an effective date. Darwin will walk us through the preliminaries, and then we have folks online to get into the heavy details. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Darwin Peterson, staff to Senator John Torgerson. Senate Bill 319 is an act relating to shallow natural gas leasing. Shallow gas leasing was originally proposed as a program that would enable exploration and production of shallow natural gas deposits. One of the features of the program was to encourage a new energy supply to villages, mines, and other rural users. The program is fully operational with over 100 leases processed and nearly 200 more pending. The program has become a vehicle for commercial gas development in Fairbanks, Big Delta, Mattsu Valley, and the Lower Kenai Peninsula. Senate Bill 319 is intended to advance the program into a more robust and viable commercial program that should benefit all parties. Because the program has become more commercial in nature, increasing revenues from application fees and annual rental fees is appropriate. The program will still neither involve competitive bidding nor require bonus bids. However, application fees for shallow gas leases have been increased from $500 to $5,000, and an annual rental fee has been increased from 50 cents to $1 per acre. The increased fees are designed to increase revenue and pay for the program costs, while not discouraging parties of genuine interest and ability from developing shallow natural gas resources. The requirement that DNR annually notify a lessee by certified mail of rental due has been deleted. Rent would automatically be due on the date determined in the lease. Deadlines have proven to be unworkable and do not recognize the work required by DNR to prepare leases in areas that are populated and may have complex land ownership patterns. The limitation on depth to 3,000 feet has been replaced with the requirement that some portion of the field must be within 3,000 feet. The total amount of acreage that may be held by shallow natural gas lessees has been increased from 46,080 acres to an aggregate of 100,000 acres. The acreage increase reflects the fact that large acreage may be necessary as a shallow gas program. The requirement that the applicant conduct a title search will be removed. DNR routinely conducts a title search for land before leases are issued. Additionally, there are no title companies who will conduct a thorough title search of the subsurface estate and warranty title. These changes will improve reservoir management value to the lessee and the state. New bonding provisions would demonstrate lessees are fiscally responsible and would help protect surface owners. The lessee must secure the bond as a precondition to obtaining the lease. In the event that the surface estate is owned by a private party, an additional bond may be required if the lessee and the private party cannot reach an agreement. Lessees will have from July 1st, 2002 through September 30th, 2002, approximately 90 days, to convert leases from the existing program to the new program if they so choose. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I believe Mark Myers, the Director of Division of Oil and Gas, is online for questions, and we have members of the industry who are here to testify as well.
Thank you, Darwin. We'll go to Mark Myers. He's going to answer most of the questions on this. Mark, do you have testimony?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll have some questions for you, I believe.
Okay. I want to thank Darwin for, I think, an excellent summary of the bill, and from that, a fair amount of the intent, I think, is evident of the changes. First of all, DNR strongly supports the legislation. It recognizes the shale gas leasing original intent was for rural energy in remote areas and anticipated a few weeks to the village, typically 2 by 3 mile leases in the large plus acre leases. So it wouldn't take very many of them when you had holes to provide sufficient energy for a rural village. Again, the original intent was that. The program, though, it quickly evolved into a commercial program. So the program was passed in 96. We have about 300 that are pending leases encompassing almost 1.3 million acres of land. So we have a lot of acres that are under lease or about to be under lease on this program. So we have a good look at the pattern of leasing. What we've seen is that leases are in clusters near fairly large residential areas of the community around the Fairbanks Big Delta area, the northern Mattsu area, down by the Homer area. Again, so fundamentally, those large lot leases are appropriate for fairly large scale commercial gas development, if assuming there is shallow gas or coal bed methane or both in those areas. So we looked at the program in terms of what this program really needs to have to be an effective commercial program, as well as still keep the original intent if it should be used by villages or in rural areas. And it will say right now about 1.5% of our leases, or 4 leases, are in Red Dog and Meeple area, which is within that original intended sphere, and the rest are in these higher density population areas near the larger cities. So we have some dual purpose. And in crafting changes that both the industry needed and we felt we were needed for effective management and to provide fair revenue to pay for the program, we tried to come up with a series of changes that would balance everyone's needs to come out of the win-win situation. To that end, we worked with AOGA, with Cominco, with Unicel Evergreen, other folks that had a direct interest in seeing a successful exploration of the shallow gas leasing program. So these changes are that amending the 3,000 foot depth is a fairly big deal. The problem with the 3,000 feet is the geologic formations, the coal or shallow gas, typically just at an angle. And often the field may start above 3,000 feet but continue on below 3,000 feet. So we have a real correlative rise problem if production should come from the shallow horizon, but often maybe draining gas below that, where the state would have 100% federal ownership. We'd be in a dog and cat fight with the AODCC proving our corrosive rights and create a mess. So again, from a commercial standpoint, the mineral rights are, I don't think, ever defined in these terms. They're typically defined to a geologic formation or a grassroots. The other problem is the current 3,000 feet is a surface depth rather than a fixed depth based on sea level. But the terrain undulates, the depth that you can drill to undulates. So it creates a huge problem from either reservoir management from a lefty standpoint. And furthermore, often the coal seams that for coal bed methane might extend from a few hundred feet down to depths of about 4,500 feet. So we felt it was fair for the lefty to be able to capture the reserves of the entire area. But for quite frankly, the mineral rights that subjugate a state below 3,000 aren't going to be worth all that much if it's the gas potential anyway. So for logical development and maximizing production, we felt the mineral rights ought to be in field starts above 3,000, ought to be for the entire field accumulation. That concern, I think, was illustrated. 3,000 feet. Part of the field being above 3,000 feet is to honor the original intent of the bill that not be a grassroots gas exploration play. That still has to be a criteria of being shallow, part of it being shallow. Changing the fee to $5,000, right now it costs us about $2,000 per lease due to the title work. The current bill does not require us to do the title work, but in fact we found we in fact would have to do it. The main reason we have to do it is because private parties cannot get insurance on title work, so we have no way to verify the title work was done in a reasonable manner without actually retracing and redoing it effectively anyway. We felt since we had to go through those tests anyway, and title insurance wasn't an available option, we might as well not burden Lefty with it. Might as well just go ahead and do it ourselves. So from a practical management standpoint, we felt that changing the title language made good sense and, again, took a burden away from the Lefty. And part of that was saving him money and helped justify the $5,000. Look at the $5,000 itself. It's still less than a dollar per acre for a typical lease, which is well under any of our competitive leasing terms. So we felt, again, the terms are reasonable, affordable, and I think there was general concurrence in the industry that was so. We also wanted to increase the total acreage from the 46,000 acres under the old bill to the 100,000 acres max per company, per individual. And the reason for that was the coal bed is typically produced in fairly large units, whereas entire area is watered. So their units are commonly 70 or 80,000 acres in size to begin with to maximize production from the coal bed, from a coal bed from an area. So again, in the commercial sense, a large unit makes total sense. Around the village, it wouldn't be necessary for a small amount of coal bed, but in a commercial sense, the company physically needs to be able to acquire more acreage. So again, I think a significant benefit is the recognition of the commercial parts of this program. In terms of dealing with the raising the rental from 50 cents per acre to a dollar, again, that's as cheap as we get. Our original conventional leases can start at a dollar, but they accelerate to a dollar 50 to 50 cents each year, the term of the lease. So this stays at a dollar. We again think that's affordable and again provides more revenue to the state. We felt that our oil and gas program should, in fact, at least pay for themselves and afford to pay for themselves. So that was merely a financial decision, I guess, that we believe, again, doesn't affect the fundamental economics of exploration by people who reasonably want to explore. As far as the bonding requirement, we are concerned that a lot of these shallow gas leases in our current pattern are in areas where the private land ownership is much more concentrated than on our slope or in some areas of Cook Inlet. In fact, we see an overlay of multiple and a 3 mile lease, a lot of private land owners. We're concerned about getting an applicant in there who hasn't had a tradition of oil and gas development and may not understand the plan of operation and approval and may actually enter the land or do damage to the land without getting the landowner's agreement or without going through the community process with us. So putting a bond up front simply provided extra protection to those surface owners that we thought was appropriate and not too long. That bond then will be looked at in terms of any additional bonding amounts needed later on in the federal operations from those amounts. So again, I think the net dollars for the operations wouldn't be zero, but we would have that bond up front to prevent the screen out folks that might A, not be really be able to afford the leases, and B, might cause incidental damage by not getting the plan of an operations permit. And then there's just an assuredness to the folks out there in these areas that they do have some protection. And part of that is this is an over-the-counter program, not a program where the state selects which areas it's leasing and designs the lease. They go out there, they pick the area they want, and they apply to us, and we grant it. Based on the timing of their application. So that's another reason to have the bonding up there in front. As far as other significant changes to the bill, it provides a chance for someone to convert their leases from the current program to the, which limits their rights to 3,000 feet and has those provisions to this new program. That was important to several companies that really want to utilize these leases for commercial development. And again, we think that's fair. We'd like to limit the scope to make the decision rather than constantly converting leases. So we want an adequate open period where someone could make up their mind and reverse the program should they want to. Those are really the main points in the legislation. And again, I want to stress that, recognize that this is an important program to take now, providing energy to the Fairbanks, the Upper Valley, and the Homer area is quite positive. We want to see the program work, so we can get these changes to be effective as a commercial program. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
Just a real quick question, Mr. Chairman. Mike, I think I understand the bill, but could you tell me why you're making the change that on page 3, lines 13 and 14, that allows the director to terminate the lease if the renter fails to pay? If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, do you still have the authority to terminate a lease if, in fact, rent is not paid?
Yes, we certainly believe we do.
In other parts of the statute?
Yes, terminating is not by act of law. So it doesn't take away. The problematic part was that it put the onus on us to notify them rather than for them to assure they paid their rent.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Halford and Senator Taylor now and have some questions on bonding. I wonder if you can walk us through why the $500,000 walk us through some of the discussions on bonding, and I think it'll lead us to a couple more questions. That's on page 4, line 16.
Right. On line 16, the $500,000 is a statewide bond that's there for oil and gas activities now. And we felt, again, this putting this bond up front was to assure that the lessee, since there really are no other qualifications, then they went down their $5,000. Had the wherewithal, if there were to cause surface damage, to cover that damage. Someone that has a $5,000 statewide bond, we felt, was responsible and the recourse was there. Therefore, we felt that they should be exempted from this requirement to put the extra $50,000 or amount up front. So it simply was a recognition of the purpose of this bond and that it really wasn't necessary if someone already had a statewide bond. There was plenty of recourse to go back. To recover, they're fiscally responsible, and there's money there if they the statewide bond if there is damage to the service of the state.
Okay.
I think you confused me a bit. The paragraph talks in terms of someone who has already posted a statewide bond of at least $500,000, but then if you look on page 5. At line 23, it talks about $25,000 per incident, unless it's subject to the amendments we just made on 3805177. I guess what my question is, if I'm going to go into the shallow gas leasing business, I put up my $5,000, I pay $1 an acre annual fee, do I also have to put up a $500,000 bond?
Senator Taylor, to the chair, no, you don't. The bonding in the state has, there are multiple bonds in the state. this bill deals with some of those various bonds in addition to adding another one. But the additional bond you have on page 527 is a DEP bond. There's nothing at DNR issues, but it's based on concern about cuttings and weight and other issues. But that's something that relates to the actual operation of drilling, not acquiring the lead or not involved. So that's an operational bond that DEP requires, in essence. We're talking charge issues. Going back to the $500,000 bond, that is basically a statewide bond that company can post if they like, and then they have no other requirement in the lease acquisition part with DNR. So they're very, the different agency bonds, they're for very different purposes. Again, the attempt here in that part B on page 54, line 13, to recognize somebody already had a statewide bond, they did need to have a bond on part two there.
Well, maybe you could just answer the question this way. As I started off in a hypothetical, I decide tomorrow I'm going into the shallow gas leasing business and I'm going to go out and drill and look for shallow gas. I have to pay you $5,000, then I have to pay you $1 an acre for the area that I'm leasing. Tell me what I have to then pay to you and to other agencies in the form of bonds before the permits can issue for me to actually start drilling a hole.
Okay, Senator Taylor, if I may, I'll turn over to Jim Haynes, who's in charge of our permitting group, to go through it, go through the regular bond requirements. And this would apply to a conventional oil and gas well as well, with the exceptions in this bill.
Yes, sir. There are three agencies.
Get closer to the mic there, if you could.
Three agencies within state government have bonding requirements. The Oil and Gas Conservation Commission requires a $200,000 statewide bond to plug and abandon a well that may be left improperly in place. DEC, the $25,000 bond that we're taught, that you mentioned, is a DEC bond for indicating financial responsibility. DEC's bonding requirements range from a low of $25,000 for financial responsibility to as high as $121 million, depending on the type of facility that you're talking about. DNR requires a $100,000 bond for a single well.
How much was that? Did you blur it out?
Sorry, $100,000 for a single well.
Okay.
$500,000 for a statewide bond, which would include shallow gas. What the bill says, I believe, is that if you have a $500,000 bond in place, such as Unocal, for example, they do not have to bond additionally for a shallow gas operation.
So the $500,000 is existing law. We're just putting an exemption in here if you have it for statewide.
That's right.
Okay. There was a question that might be a little low, but that's current law, so you don't believe that's a little low, right?
It hasn't been so far.
Well, now you got me scared.
Yeah.
So let me just wrap this up. I step up the counter. I give you the $5,000 to get the permit. I give you $1 an acre for the area I'm going to lease to drill for shallow gas. I then give a $200,000 bond to the Oil and Gas Commission to make sure I plug up any holes that I leave. I give a $25,000 bond, but the way I read that, it says per incident. It's somewhere between a $25,000 bond and a $121 million bond to DEC for whatever they construe my activities to be and what the risks are there. And then I have to come up, if I'm going to drill more than one single hole, I then have to come up with another $500,000 for a statewide bond with DNR, which would include this gas. Is that right?
Yes, sir, that's correct. With there is one thing, I can't speak for DEC, but the per incident language if you're drilling a well with a drilling rig, that would, I believe, in their interpretation, cover it, because then when you move the drill rig to the next hole, you have another incident. If you had three drill rigs running, you probably, it could be construed that you had three incidents, but this is a DEC thing, and I don't know exactly how they would interpret that. We're concerned with $500,000.
But the very least I could get by with for bonding to get my first permit is going to be $725,000 in bond before I can drill a shallow gas hole, right?
Yes, sir.
And you said that wasn't enough?
The question is, I guess, what are you bonding for in part, Senator Taylor? Some of these bonds are to make sure that the well is abandoned properly. Some of these bonds are to protect the surface estate. And other bonds are to deal with oil spill cleanup issues. So it's not a combined pool that's usable for all these purposes. They're individual bonds for specific purposes that are all different.
Yeah, I understood that part. Thanks.
Okay, other questions for Mr. Myers? There appear to be none. Thank you. You might hang online just in case. We will now go to Mark Saxton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Mark Saxton. I am the president and CEO of Evergreen Resources Alaska Corporation, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Evergreen Resources, Inc. I'm also president and CEO of Evergreen Resources, which is an independent energy company trading on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol EBG. Currently, Evergreen has 46,080 acres of shallow gas lease applications located in the Willow area. These applications are pending with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas. Today, I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 319. This bill removes obstacles to our ability to explore for and to develop shallow natural gas. Evergreen Resources Alaska's functional specialties extend to Alaska the main focus of Evergreen Resources, which is unconventional natural gas extraction, such as coal bed methane extraction and other shallow natural gas development. These activities require at least 100,000 acres to establish the necessary economies of scale for an initial development program. We strongly support increasing the depth limitation to one that relies on science and geology for the specific geologic play and concept. We're certain we can drill, complete, and produce natural gas wells below 3,000 feet in a safe and environmentally responsible manner using the currently existing technologies that we already employ every day. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the shallow natural gas program is the primary reason Evergreen is in Alaska. And we're grateful that the legislature is making this program possible as well as improving it. The changes proposed in this bill do provide us the necessary latitude to operate in an economically sound and environmentally safe manner. And we acknowledge this vision of oil and gas for collaborating with us and other stakeholders. This, in our minds, is an excellent example of how state agencies and industry can work together to the benefit of all interested parties, including and particularly the public. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. John Kanagawa, our Alaska Project Manager, and Jack Ekstrom of Public Affairs will be in Juneau tomorrow and Friday to provide any further information that would be helpful to this process. And if you want, I would be pleased to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mark. Question, Senator Taylor.
Yeah, one. Could you give me a comparison of the bonding requirements that are required of a company like yours in gas states where there is shallow gas? And I don't know what those may be. I'm just guessing maybe Oklahoma and the Dakotas and maybe someplace in Texas.
Well, as you're aware, it varies quite a bit state to state. Generally, it's actually quite a bit less in Colorado. It's really only a $25,000 statewide bond. And we also have other $25,000 bonds separate for operating within federal units. So we have separate bonds with the activities, but the bonds are considerably less.
I mean, are they that dramatically less, 10 to 15 times less in these other states? Because we're talking about a bonding, if you understood the testimony earlier, a bonding requirement to punch your first hole of $725,000 as an absolute minimum.
That's right, and that is exactly right. I think the issue really has come down to the fact that even as large as those numbers are, when you look at the cost of bonds, bonding really represents a small portion, just a few percent of the total cost to drill, complete, and produce a shallow gas well. If an operator cannot afford a bond, even if it's just the $500,000 statewide oil and gas bond, it's probably unlikely that they will have the financial resources to successfully drill and produce a single exploration well, much less implementing a full multi-well program in the sort of orderly development way that I think the state wants to see. So I personally have mixed feelings about it. I think that, it's to be encouraged, but the reality is to do business in Alaska properly and to do coal bed methane extraction, which requires planning to drill quite a few wells, if you really, the operators who can afford to do such a program can easily afford this type of bonding.
Well, that's the part that has me concerned, is that through this guise, we may very well be excluding this to a limited club of operators, as you said, who can afford to do this drilling. It's my understanding that over 30% of the oil produced in the United States today comes from wildcatters, and that a higher percent than that comes from wildcatters drilling for gas. And I don't think you encourage them to go out there if the only boys that can play in the game have to have a $1 million check before they can show up and put their ante up at the table. Obviously, Colorado doesn't feel that way, and obviously the federal government doesn't either. If they're only requiring a $25,000 bond statewide in that state, I don't necessarily believe that Alaska is any more precious than Colorado is to the people who live in Colorado. So I'm having a hard time understanding why there's that great variance between the bonding requirements, and I'm suspicious that the bonding requirements we currently have, that on this very bill we're talking about existing law of $50 million per incident, $20 million bond, $10 million bond. What that does, that excludes, in my opinion, a vast array of people who might be out there searching for better resources for us today, but they're precluded by these bonds. And I would appreciate your comment on that.
This is just my personal opinion, but it is going to be more costly to do business in Alaska. Evergreen has taken the approach that to do this right, we are going to have to be looking and planning to develop at least 100,000 acres to get the proper economies of scale. I think we're talking about potentially two different concepts. The real difference between coming into a highly populated area where services are generally available and infrastructure is available, such as the Matsu Valley area, it's necessary to do that right and give people a measure of confidence versus perhaps the effort that's going to be required to drill a few wells in outlying villages. The wells drilled in outlying villages are actually going to be fairly limited because the market there will be limited, but it ought to be and hopefully will be a good long-term source of natural gas for these outlying areas. However, it's going to be very costly to get the equipment there, and you want to make sure you're dealing with well-financed, ethical companies that are going to be able to do it right, because while the cost for Alaska can certainly be quantified relative to drilling wells in Oklahoma or Kansas or Colorado or Texas, the reality is the cleanup cost in Alaska, especially in remote areas, if someone doesn't do it right, I would expect to be greater than what we would experience here, where services are more readily available and where the equipment's more readily available. I'll remind everyone that Evergreen is planning to bring in drilling rigs specialized drilling rigs and specialized fracture stimulation and completion equipment to do the work in Alaska, which currently doesn't exist.
Well, I don't necessarily, Senator Taylor is making a comparison to one well, and there is no such thing as one well methane shallow gas field that I know of. There's maybe 1,500 wells to a field, or whatever you think you're going to drill up in Mat-Su, and $500,000 is a bargain.
I hope that's a correct statement. I'm looking forward to proving that statement true.
Okay. Thank you. Let's go to Dave Lappy.
Yes, thank you, Senator, and the rest of the committee. I'm Dave Lappy, President of Lapp Resources, Inc., and my comments today represent myself as an Alaskan and my company, Lapp Resources, and do not represent the position of any other company or organization. I'm in support of the proposed changes to shallow gas leasing contained in this bill. The proposed bonding to cover damage to the surface will reduce the cost to the Division of Oil and Gas in administering these provisions while providing good protection of local resources. The proposed acreage limitation from 46,080 acres to 100,000 acres will allow the companies to establish larger acreage positions necessary to justify the risks and expenses in developing this new resource. I was in Juneau recently and expressed concerns to some of you regarding fee increases in the proposed bill. After some discussion with the Division of Oil and Gas, I agree that they will see some increased costs related to permitting, service landowner liaison, and well site inspections if a substantial number of wells are drilled under this program. While it would be nice if these monies, if monies to cover these increased costs could be raised closer to the source of the expense, right, that is closer to the drilling and production phase rather than at the application stage, I firmly believe it's in the best interest of the state not to shortchange the DNR and the Division of Oil and Gas that are the source of the vast majority of our state income. Allowing explorers to follow gas productive horizons below 3,000 feet is a sensible change that will increase the potential gas resource available under this program while reducing the cost of developing these deeper horizons. On page 5, line 26 and 27, I suggest substituting the words, some portion of which is within 3,000 feet of the surface for the proposed language. This would eliminate reclassifying shallow gas wells to oil and gas wells on leases other than shallow gas leases, that is, standard oil and gas leases, exploration licenses, private land, and federal land. I propose the same language be used on page 6, line 26, to prevent increased bonding costs. The current bond is $25,000 per well, which would rise to $1 million per well associated with shallow gas exploration wells on lands other than shallow gas leases. I urge the Senate Resources Committee to approve the bill and help us develop this new energy resource. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Thank you. There appear to be none. Judy Brady.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Judy Brady. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The Alaska Oil and Gas Association supports this bill. Shallow gas leasing is an important potential for the state of Alaska for all the reasons that you've already heard. And it was the fourth piece of legislation the legislature in the last few years have passed that cured many of the access problems to this state, including area-wide leasing, exploration licensing, and then shallow gas. These modifications that are proposed in this bill solve some of the issues that both the companies have faced and the Department of Natural Resources have faced, and they solve those problems in a practical way. Thank you very much for introducing me.
Statewide
is
500.
Like I said, we are supporting.
One well was 100.
Well was 100.
Okay, thank you. The question is for Mr. Brady. Hey, thank you, Judy, for sticking with us this afternoon. Kevin Tabler, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Resource Committee, my name is Kevin Tabler, Manager of Land and Government Affairs for Union Oil Company in California here in Alaska, commonly known as UNICAL. I appreciate this opportunity to be heard today and comment on Senate Bill 319. As we speak, UNICAL Utah is conducting an aggressive gas exploration program in the Cook Inlet area and is very interested in any legislation dealing with gas and gas exploration. The shallow gas leasing program augments the existing area-wide leasing program and enhances the access to and development of the state's natural gas resources. We're very supportive of this program and other leasing programs providing access to the state's mineral wealth. I've listened today to the remarks of Director Myers of the Division of Oil and Gas and others testifying in support of this bill and wish to lend Unocal's support in passage of this legislation for the very reasons articulated in Director Myers' remarks. Amendments identified in Senate Bill 319 provide for better administration and clarification of the shallow gas leasing program and are in the best interest of the state of Alaska. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Kevin? There are none. Thank you, sir, for hanging out. Ms. McKay, that's all we have on teleconference on that, so.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Charlotte McKay. I am the Senior Administrator of Environmental and Regulatory Affairs for Tecminco, Alaska. Tecminco and our partner, Nanan Regional Corporation, thank you for this opportunity. I'm here today to talk about the potential for shale bed methane gas around the Red Dog mine. Briefly, Red Dog employs 400 people, about 60% of the shareholders. We produce over 1 million tons of zinc and lead concentrates a year. To crush the ore and make the concentrate requires about 28 megawatts of power using approximately 18 million gallons of diesel per year that we transport to the port and then up the road by truck on a daily basis. Replacing the diesel consumption with gas would reduce our air emissions by about half, as well as reduce the risks of the oil transport to the port, the storage, and the transfer up to the mine site. In the packets I gave you, there's a few aerial photos of the terrain around the area. As you can see, it's fairly rugged. It varies a lot. It is not flat like the terrain of the Matanuska Valley or Prudhoe Bay. These pictures clearly show that it's very rugged and we need a more flexible determination for the depth limitation for the shallow gas lease. It would be very difficult to follow a surface depth at Red Dog. Currently, there's a map in there as well. Tecminco holds 4 state shallow gas leases for about 23,000 acres, and Nana has the adjoining land to the east where there's nearly 100,000 acres. The current lease limitation of 46,000 acres to any one company is not sufficient for the project. The suggested 100,000 limit would be much more supported by us. The fee changes requested by the administration are considerably more than the initial legislation. Cominco can support the fee increases if the monies remain within the shallow gas program. There we would find that beneficial. Otherwise, we would find it an expenditure that would not be good for the business. Development of shallow gas fields in Northwest Alaska have many impediments. Some areas share and some don't. Location is a major impediment due to access and the ability to bring large equipment in and out only in the summer months. We do not have access to bring things in by ice road and do that during the winter months. So this is a high cost for us. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to test a shallow gas lease within the 3 years provided in the current lease when work is so seasonal. Logic would say a lease should be at least 5 years for a primary term with renewal options as provided in the current lease. Although this is not provided in the legislation, we would support a 5-year term with renewal options. Development of a shallow gas field is much different than a conventional field in Cook Inlet or on the slope. Instead of 2 to 5 holes to develop a gas field, as you've been mentioning, it would take 50 to 100 holes. And the cost per hole needs to be kept at a minimum or a field becomes uneconomic quickly. To date, Cominco has opportunistically piggybacked on the mineral exploration effort in the Red Dog area as a tool to defray the costs and delineate the area's potential gas resource. The methane gas we have found is low pressure and is located lateral to and underlying the ore zones. Extensive work has been completed to date using the mineral exploration tools, but the next phase is to conduct a flow test to see if that gas will let loose. This flow test cannot be supported until the depth below the surface of a field is better defined. We have already found gas down to 3,000 feet. We know it's at least that deep, and the geologic structure indicates that it will go considerably deeper. Arctic operations will always present numerous challenges not present elsewhere. Tetkaminko, Alaska, and Nanav address many of these each and every day at Red Dog. By passing this legislation, you will help us address some more. And we support SB 319.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Are you suggesting an amendment to the five-year term?
Yes. We'd like to see that in there.
You understand we don't have the ability to dedicate funds, so your first concern about keeping those revenues within the shallow gas program may be beyond our capacity.
It's not possible to do that in a program receipt type.
We can try that, but it's always subject to appropriation by the next folks that come through the door.
We appreciate the consideration of it.
Okay, thank you.
One quick question.
Yes.
You stated that the wells would be, it could be over 3,000 feet deep, but the bill addresses within 3,000 feet of the surface. Is that a problem for you all then? Are you identifying that?
The legislation only extends to 3,000 feet. This bill would allow it to go deeper if you're within the same resource unit. So if you've tapped into it within 3,000 feet, but it extends deeper, this bill would allow us to have access to that resource.
Part of the field must be within 3,000 feet.
Right.
Part, not all.
Okay.
And we do have part of it.
All right.
We believe it goes much further. We haven't drilled any further than that, but we believe it much
better.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else here to testify?
Mr. Chair, this is Mark Myers.
Yeah, Mark.
In respect to the five-year term, the legislation gives the director the ability to extend beyond for a period for not more than an additional 3 years. So there's discretion to actually have a six-year term if they're making solid progress for development. Again, we would certainly do that. We agree 3 years is a pretty short leash to do this, but we have two tools. One is the specific language and statutes gives us an additional 3 years to make progress, and I've only seen positive progress there. Again, I would fully expect that a reasonable exploration plan would lead to extension of lease. The other is practically, you know, and this is something that Mark Sykes and my office has found out, is that most probably production of a larger scale would be from unitized production, particularly in their area where there's two different subsurface owners. So we expect to form a unit which would then continue to hold leases for a longer period of time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Who's this?
Ken Boyd.
Yes, sir?
Would you like some more happy talk and support, or have you had enough for today?
Well, personally, I've had enough for today. But
okay.
Go ahead, Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ken Boyd. I'm currently an oil and gas consultant. I'm here representing myself, no company or other organizations. I was director of the Division of Oil and Gas when the bill was originally passed and the program established in 1996. I'd like to put my voice on the record in support of the changes to the bill. I think you've covered the bill in enough detail. I have to go through it. I think the extending the depth below 3,000 feet is valuable, increasing the number of acres. It just increases the opportunity to use the bill. I think the increase in the fees is appropriate. I think the bonding may help out with the landowners. And it won't solve the split estate problem, but I think it goes a long way to giving landowners more comfort. Simply say, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think this bill makes the program better. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Is there anybody else online that would like to testify on 319? For some reason, I'm not getting the normal sheets that we do on that. Okay, let's, I want to take just about a 2 minute at ease here, right? Let's go back on record, please. Mr. Myers, you're still with us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and is your bonding expert still there with us?
Yes, he is.
Okay, we want to, Senator Halford has some questions on bonding, and so we'll go back and reopen up that. And then we do have one amendment that I It's actually a technical amendment that I want to take up. Senator Halper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for going back to that, and I apologize. I had a meeting in my office, had to go to and then come back. But the concern I had was that in these kinds of operations, you can have multiple rigs operating. And if they're operating in fairly high-density developed areas around Fairbanks, around Mattoon, I'm just worried whether $500,000 is enough for a bond for surface damage. I mean, you can, there's things you can do that can drain everybody's water well. There's a lot that can happen. And by the way, that may not be their fault either. You know, there's a lot that can get charged that didn't happen too. But I am just concerned, and I'd like to hear what the Division of Lands has to say, or the department has to say, and any other division about the level of the bond when it's applied statewide. As I believe there are going to be more and more conflicts between the people who own the surface estate and the subsurface estate, because most people do not understand that they don't control paramount authority over the subsurface estate. In fact, it's reversed.
Okay, you got that, Mark?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman. And I don't think we have a representative division of land here, but I think one thing to keep in mind is with gas, like because of the risk, it's probably going to it's not going to occur all the thing. It's sort of site specific, so the $500,000 has to be replenished as, you know, if they start to draw down on that. So I think that's the concept of the statewide, recognizing there should not be multiple simultaneous draws on that individual bond. We do have what we believe that $500,000 statewide is as high. Whether it's adequate protection, I mean, I think that needs to be looked at not just in the sense of this program, but more in the sense of our overall oil and gas program where there's oil risk as well. So, I mean, I think the debate is a much larger debate than just the bill. So an overall maybe review of the state's overall bonding requirements, what we're asking here.
Was that an answer that we needed more or needed less or don't know?
The answer is I think we're comfortable with the current levels, but if we do look at more, I think it needs to be looked at in regard to the conventional program as well. I have not heard a concern that our $500,000 statewide bond will go before. So I guess it's an honest, I don't know, but I would say this program is probably less risky than the conventional oil program where the $500,000 bond flies. We also, if there's an unusual risk, we have the authority to request larger bonds. So there is that potential.
Well, the difference in the risk, the risk to the state in large parcels is a different kind of a risk than the risk to developed areas in small parcels. That's what I agree that you're, you know, a gas leak is a lot different than an oil spill, but there's a difference in the kind of expectations and parcels and the expertise of the people involved when you're dealing with small subdivision lots and small parcels of land.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, I would concur with that. I don't think, I'll give you an honest, I don't know the answer. I think the issue needs to be looked at from a broader context, and then also we have to be concerned about the economic effect on the industry as well. So there's a balancing there clearly with bonds. So I don't have a good answer for you.
What do you think the cost of a $500,000 bond is going to be for a reasonable sized independent?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's around 20% of the actual bond amount. And it will depend on market conditions will change.
Is that a cost that's annually earned, or is that an amount that has to remain in escrow?
That's an annual